Thanks so much for joining us here today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're starting the show today by talking with you about aquaponics. It's a way to dramatically increase crop production with a fraction of the water you need for traditional farming. You don't need chemical fertilizers or pesticides, but you do need live fish and live plants to make it work. And we have a working aquaponic system in a greenhouse on the UW-Madison campus. And we'll talk about aquaponics in general and about that greenhouse with our guest, Johanna Oosterwijk. Johanna is manager of the D.C. Smith Greenhouse in the UW-Madison Department of Plant and Agroecosystem Sciences. She's been at the greenhouse for a long time now, 18 years, my goodness. And it's hard to believe it's been that long. But you can join in with your questions as we move along today, as we talk about aquaponics. Hope you'll join in. Give a call at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Johanna Oosterwijk, welcome. Good to have you back.
Good to be here, Larry. It's always a pleasure to join you on your show.
Let's talk, aquaponics has been around a long time, hasn't it?
It really has. I mean, the modern way that we think about it combined with controlled environment agriculture is probably 20 to 30 years old, but you can certainly find examples of folks growing crops fertilized by fish, you know, way back as long as we've been doing agriculture, especially when you think about wet agriculture, like, say, rice paddies.
Yeah, yeah. China was big on it millennia back, and I know that even the Aztecs, I read somewhere, had an aquaponic system. So it's amazing system and pretty gaining in popularity, is it not?
It certainly is. So as folks are looking for alternative ways to grow crops, systems that can be close to consumers. So it's an option for urban agricultural systems. It doesn't take up a lot of space, a lot of land. So when there's not a lot of room to grow a large field of something, we can turn to aquaponics and other controlled environment systems to make better use of the space and actually grow more in a smaller space than we could if we laid everything outside in a field.
Yeah, right about that. Well, you're the manager of the D.C. Smith Greenhouse on the UW-Madison campus. It's a cool spot on campus. tell us about the greenhouse.
Well, thanks. I love the greenhouse. I've been here almost 20 years, as you said. And it is the teaching greenhouse for the College of Agriculture. So if you come to campus, there are actually a lot of greenhouses. This one focuses on instruction primarily for undergraduates, though we do see some graduate work as well. And that's what our aquaponics system is for. It's integrated into the teaching that instructors in the College of Agriculture do, one of which I am. I teach classes in greenhouse cultivation. So we use the aquaponics system there. We also host classes for other classes in the Department of Plant and Agroecosystem Sciences, but the greenhouse is for the entire college. So we have classes for the plant pathology department and for entomology, for forest products.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And we also welcome the public. So we have some outreach events. We offer tours for community groups, school kids. And I will say we're going to have a public event on May 3rd when, if folks are interested, they can come and check out our aquaponics system. So that's a Saturday. We're not usually open on Saturdays.
Yeah.
But that event will be 10 to 1 Saturday, May 3rd. You can stop by the campus and see the greenhouses, but also the Allen Gardens and the Energy Institute and Library will be open as well.
Yeah, that should be a cool day for sure. Well, let's talk about the aquaponics system. What's the size and scale of the one you have at the greenhouse?
We have a very modest scale system. It's still large for us. It fills up half of a greenhouse. The footprint is 200 square feet, which is a lot for our small rooms. It's half the growing space that we have there. You can have a very small tabletop system all the way up to a, you know, full-size multi-greenhouse system. You see them at all different scales. This system works well for our classes. It's you know, not a huge commitment in space, though it does take up half of one of our rooms, as I said. And we can grow, 20 to 40 fish in a 100-gallon tank, along with two tanks of hydroponically grown vegetables. And each of those tanks is about, 24 square feet each. So we have about 50 square feet of growing space plus a 100-gallon tank for the fish.
How do the fish and talk about how the fish and the plants support each other?
So the synergy of aquaponics is that you're getting extra work out of a system. So where you have a single system with hydroponics, you would be growing plants in water culture and adding probably a synthetic fertilizer, but you'd have fertilizer as an input. In aquaculture, where you're growing fish farming, you have your tanks of fish, but you also need to have some filtration system to get rid of the fish waste. The really great thing about aquaponics is that you blend these two together and you get some savings. You get the cost savings of fertilizer because the fish waste becomes the fertilizer for the plants, so you're using that waste product, and the plants become the filtration system for the fish. So it's less expensive than growing an individual aquaculture system and an individual hydroponics system. You bring them together and you have that synergy where they work together using the fertilizer for the fish and the fish as the filtration system for the plants.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Fish and plants are grown there through aquaponics?
Well, we chose the easy beginner level. I have lots of experience in greenhouses, but I don't even have a fish tank at home. So I came to this from the hydroponics, growing plants in controlled environments aspect. So I wanted the easy care version of fish, and we chose tilapia. There's a reason they are the most common fish in aquaponic systems. They're a popular food fish, and they're quite tolerant of a wide range of conditions. So as we, as growers and fish caretakers, were learning about this new, you know, livestock, I guess you could call it a school, we wanted to make sure that we, kept things right for them. But the tilapia can tolerate a wide range of water temperatures, water quality. So that made it a little bit easier for us rather than trying to have to target specific requirements for a harder to raise crop of fish like perch or, trout.
Or walleye.
Or walleye, yeah. So we chose the easiest fish, though. Some folks also suggested goldfish, because then you also have that decorative aspect, and some folks would do an aquaponic system where instead of a food fish, you could grow an ornamental fish and, you know, possibly sell those off to pet stores as a source of income as well.
With the teaching aspect of it, are you trying to just raise awareness among the students? Certainly you're teaching them the whole operation, but what's the hope there?
The hope is to be able to teach some sustainability values. They've been used not just by the, you know, greenhouse growing classes, but they've also been an example for engineering classes. We have a professor on campus who looks at life cycle analysis. So she's an engineering professor, Andrea Hicks, who actually helped us get started and looks at inputs, outputs, and efficiency of systems. So that's another aspect of how they can be used for teaching. For my classes, I certainly want to teach about the cultivation aspects, keeping the fish healthy, keeping the plants healthy. Primarily, that's been blended into our water quality classes, because water quality is not only important for the health of the fish, it's also important for the health of the plants, and their requirements aren't always exactly the same. I mentioned temperature. The tilapia can accept a wide range of temperatures, though generally they like warmer temperatures. So I've been trying to grow crops that like a little bit warmer temperatures too.
Yeah,
and
I was going to ask.
In the greenhouse, it gets warmer.
Yeah, it gets warmer there for sure. And the plants, so what are you growing?
So the plants that we are growing, we've tried a couple different things. Currently, I have a crop of basil growing alongside of the fish tank, and they are doing really well. I tried lettuce last year, and I probably should have known lettuce like it cool. And in the greenhouse in the summer, it gets warm and the fish like it warm. So that was a poor choice on my part. But we had a lot of lettuce, and I also grow lettuce hydroponically. So I had a lot of experience with that, and I kind of wanted to compare the two systems. But one thing to think about if you're, you know, saying, well, I'd like to try aquaponics, is matching the requirements of your fish to your plant crop.
Yeah.
So if you have a warm temperature fish, look for a warm season crop. If you have a cool temperature fish like perch or trout, yeah, go for lettuce or something, but also realize you'll need to keep your environment cooler. So that might be an extra investment in some cooling systems during the summer at least.
Hmm. Helen in West Salem has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Helen.
Hi. I just want to tell you that for several years, West Salem High School has this system. And the tilapia is served at a community dinner to over 250 people once a year. And so that's just kind of an exciting thing. And they are going to be enlarging it besides. So that's my comment.
Oh, thank you. So that's at West Salem High School. Were you familiar with that, Johanna?
I'm not familiar with the West Salem system, but I know a lot of schools do incorporate these systems. Again, just they're a great way to teach a whole lot of things, economics, plant care, animal care, and the efficiency of sustainable systems as well. So they're a great option for schools.
And they feed over 200 people, Helen. That's great. a nice dinner. Helen from West Salem, thank you so much. You can join in, too. The number to call, maybe you've got a story relating to aquaponics or just a question. Number is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address, talk@WPR.org. Our guest today, Johanna Oosterwyk, who's manager of the D.C. Smith Greenhouse. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Coming up at noon today, we'll talk about spring paddling with Rutabaga Paddle Sports owner Darren Bush and Wisconsin paddling guidebook author Timothy Bauer. That's at noon here on the Larry Mueller Show. Right now, we're taking a look at aquaponics. And again, if you'd like to join in, the number to call, I hope you will, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address, talk@WPR.org. Connor emailed to ask if it's feasible to maintain an aquaponic system in an unfinished basement. He's wondering about humidity concerns, maybe are there odor control concerns or other issues with trying to do it in a residential space?
I think it is entirely possible, and I know folks who have set up both hydroponic and aquaponic systems in basements. The primary issue for the plants is going to be you'll need to spend some money on light. And depending on your choice of fish, you may also need to do some temperature control. There may be some dehumidification that needs to take place as well. You're right about that. So there's going to be some environmental monitoring that needs to take place. But you know, assuming you had the water and electricity and appropriate systems to manage the environment, it definitely can be done. There are some interesting sort of systems that are available. You can find blueprints online. A lot of folks are willing to share their information. And I think my best advice for anyone interested in sort of making a home aquaponic system would be to, you know, seek out mentors, find a network in your area. You can do that through social media. There's also a National Aquaponics Association. And most of those folks are glad to share their experiences, help you avoid some pitfalls. And, you know, learn from their mistakes and help you out saying, you know, this system kind of worked better for me. And here's where you can source the materials. Here's where you can get your fish food. And here's how you can maintain healthy plants and healthy fish at the same time.
Yeah. Eli in Iron Mountain, Michigan has something that relates to the healthiness side of things, I think. Eli, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hey, Larry. Hey, doctor. Thanks for having me, guys. Yes, so I'm just wondering how dire would it be if a tilapia were to die in the system? How quick would that removal need to be? What would the effects be on the plant? And also, is there any kind of mating system to keep the tilapia in perpetuity?
Oh, those are some good questions. So I'll take the first one about fish health first. So you certainly want to be monitoring your system at least daily. We do daily health checks when we feed the fish. We do have an automatic feeder as well, so they get fed morning and evening. But I would say that you certainly want to be aware of the health of your fish and, you know, not let anything linger in that system for more than a day. So if you're going away on vacation, find a pet sitter for the fish. So in that case, the plants won't necessarily be harmed by a dead fish floating in the system. I would be more worried about whatever killed that fish. Would that also be infecting the rest of your fish school? And you might, you know, need some help to determine whether that was, you know, the fish picking on each other, which does sometimes happen, or whether there was a mechanical fault or something else. Why did you have that fish death? So you certainly want to be doing health checks at least daily. And in the greenhouse, we absolutely do that. I mean, we were already used to coming in on the weekends to water the plants. So it wasn't a lot to ask the staff to do the additional training, take care of the fish, and also, you know, check their health, do those water quality checks that we do every day, and make sure that things were going well. So adding the fish is, you know, it is an extra level of care and consideration. So don't neglect that.
What about, you know, I also asked about mating programs. Can you get that going too?
you actually can. It depends on your species of fish, what kind of environment they're going to need for reproduction. So it depends on this fish. The ones that I've worked with the most, those tilapia, they like something on the bottom of the tank to lay their eggs in. So by keeping the bottom of the tank clean, we actually prevent them from laying eggs and those eggs from hatching. That's better for us because with my system, I kind of want to go with the school year. So we take the summer off. We harvest the fish at the end of the spring semester and we start a new school from fry that we buy in the fall. But certainly a grower can set up their own breeding program where you could collect small fry. You could allow for tilapia that some sort of sediment or like a pebbles on the bottom, let them lay their eggs and collect those fry and then hatch them out. The very young fish would do better in a separate tank system though, because otherwise they may occasionally go through the plumbing. So we have screens to keep small fish from going into the plant system. So the plant tanks are separate from the fish tanks, and there's some good reasons to keep them that way. But it's certainly doable to, just like you would in an aquaculture system, have a reproductive strategy so that you're not constantly buying new schools of fish from a supplier.
Yeah. Eli, thanks much for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. The number is 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. Kathy in Harshaw called, couldn't stay with us, but wants to know if freshwater shrimp instead of fish could work in a Wisconsin-based aquaponics system.
The short answer is yes, they could. There are aquaponic systems using a wide range of aquatic animals. So we see everything from shrimp to fish to mollusks, clams and other bivalves being used as the nutrient source for growing crops of plants.
Very cool. UW-Stevens Point supports the Northern Aquaculture Demonstration Facility in Bayfield. I'm how are facilities like that one and yours encouraging the adoption of aquaculture in Wisconsin and perhaps beyond?
Sure. The Stevens Point aquaculture program is much older and, you know, larger than our simple aquaponics system in the greenhouse that we have here. So Stevens Point offers a full aquaculture program for their students. You can get a minor in that. They also offer at least one class in aquaponics, but their focus is on fish farming primarily. So though they have also looked at aquaponics, but they come to it from the fish farming aspect, where I came to aquaponics from the plant side. So depending on which side of that you're more interested in, you know, I know more about the plants, they know more about the fish, and have a really well-developed program, including that aquaculture center. I think it's in Bayfield.
Yeah.
Where, you know, students get that hands-on experience that is so essential to good education, and which is why places like the greenhouse I manage exist.
I know they are happen to be doing some research on walleye. And of course, walleye are the most popular fish in Wisconsin. If you could figure out a way to grow them aquaponically, it would be wonderful. I think the problem that they have, well, like anybody has who's working with it, is that walleye require a period of cold water temperatures during winter for gonad development. And we don't know yet what temperature, exact temperature, or what duration of that temperature they need to have in order to. But it would be really nice if we could raise walleye aquaponically. I think, anyway, it'd be sure worth the try. And so I hope they have some success down the road with that. Vern in Boyd, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Vern.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for letting me on. I say in Milwaukee, back in the 50s, you used to have greenhouse down there. They used to waste steam that from the power plants. But up here in Stanton, they got corn to alcohol, and it generates huge amounts of CO2, 250 tons a day, plus steam. You got everything you need to make a couple acres, maybe even 3 acres of greenhouses. And it's at scale.
Vern, thanks for calling. Comment, Johanna?
Yeah, using waste sources of heat is a great way to reduce the cost of your greenhouse facility. And then if you have an aquaponic system in the greenhouse, then that's a further cost reduction. Yeah, there are certainly examples, even in Wisconsin, where we use waste heat. There's a cogeneration plant for the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater and a greenhouse attached to that using the excess heat that goes along with that power and hot water generation plant. So if you can find a waste product, that's sort of the... That's a key tenet of aquaponics, is using a waste product as an input in a different system. So yeah, if there was a way to heat a greenhouse with steam off of corn silage, that'd be interesting. I might, you know, follow up with some of the other plant science or PAS faculty, since we have a lot of research going on into corn and other grains here in the department.
Yeah, very cool. Thanks again for that comment. Jeff emailed to say that wild salmon have pink flesh naturally, but most farm salmon have coloring added to their food to give that color. What's the difference, or what's missing? What's used, and maybe what's used to create that color, if you're familiar?
Oh, no, that's a question about the fish, which is less up my alley, but... yeah, I have heard that, and they basically add food sources that have that right coloring. I think it comes down to the same thing that happens with flamingos in zoos. They have to feed them the right food sources. Flamingos would naturally feed on shrimp, and then they pick up that pink coloration in their feathers. Same thing with salmon. It comes down to what are you feeding them, and does that have the raw materials that they need to build up those pink colors?
Yeah.
But I don't know what exactly the feed is that salmon need.
Let's talk about ammonia for a minute. A byproduct of fish waste is ammonia, which high concentrations, of course, can be toxic to fish. How's the ammonia converted into a form of nitrogen that benefits the fish?
Oh, that's a great question.
Or benefits the plants.
It is essential to what makes aquaponics work. So if you have a fish farm, your primary waste is that ammonia, which is nitrogen and hydrogen. It's just a molecule that is it's in our own waste too, as well as in fish waste. Plants need nitrogen. It's the mineral that they use the most of. So it's a great way to take that waste product from the fish and have the plants use it. However, plants don't really love ammonia. They want the nitrogen, but that ammonia plus hydrogen molecule is tough for them to absorb. So you can't see them, but there is a third set of organisms in an aquaponic system. We see the fish, we see the plants, but in between them, there's another essential organism. There's a set of bacteria that are converting the ammonia nitrogen into nitrite and then nitrate nitrogen. So there's some reactions going on at the molecular level, and they're basically shepherded along by these bacteria. So you have the bacteria in the system that remove the hydrogens from the ammonia molecule and slap on some oxygens, and that makes it into nitrite, which is nitrogen and two oxygens. Plants really love nitrate, though, which is nitrogen and three oxygens. So there's another bacteria in the system that adds another oxygen to it, and then it's in a form that is not toxic to fish, which the ammonia is, but the plants love to take up. So if you just stick the plants and the fish together, it's not going to work really well. You're still going to get overwhelming amounts of ammonia in the system because the plants really don't love ammonia. But with the bacteria there in the middle, they convert the ammonia into that nitrate, which is actually the primary form of nitrogen in most fertilizers. If you buy lawn fertilizer and you look at the guaranteed analysis, it's going to say nitrate nitrogen. And that's what the plants want. So the plants are obvious, the fish are obvious, but in the middle, there's this invisible microorganism.
Now, do you have to go out
doing the transformation?
Do you have to go out and buy these bacteria, or do they appear naturally or normally?
They are naturally occurring all over in the environment. You can certainly buy inoculants that will jumpstart your system, or you can wait for them to build up. These bacteria are not harmful to humans, but they are all around in our environment doing that chemical reaction, breaking down ammonia into nitrite and nitrate. In an aquaponic system, we actually create an environment that's hospitable to them, so to encourage them to thrive and to grow on this abundant ammonia source. So one issue with aquaponic systems can be that when you first start them up, you get these ammonia spikes, because your bacteria numbers aren't high enough, and that takes time. You can certainly purchase an inoculant to help jumpstart that, or you can give them the time and wait to allow them to naturally develop and build up. But early on in an aquaponic systems, I mentioned water testing. That water testing is essential. We test for ammonia, we test for nitrate and nitrite levels so that we can watch as the bacteria jump in and start doing their job. In a well-developed system, you'll see almost no ammonia in the water. Very early on, you'll see a lot of ammonia in the water because you don't have enough bacteria to deal with the fish waste. So in a thriving aquaponic system, even though you have a huge number of fish, you'll see very little ammonia because you have those bacteria that are converting it into the nitrate that the plants will absorb.
I was thinking about the water use in this. Aquaponic systems use, definitely a fraction of the water that is needed on a farm field.
Yes, they do.
And aquaponic systems are far more productive.
Yeah, so it's a combination between aquaponics is also leaning into the productivity that you get from hydroponics and that you get from controlled environment agriculture. So out in a farm field, you've got, you're growing your plants and you're maybe you're irrigating. If you are, a lot of that water is going to run off, some of it will evaporate, and some of it may leach down through the soil. So you lose that water in a variety of ways, in addition to what the plants themselves are actually using. In a hydroponic system, the system itself might hold a lot of water, but most of the water that leaves that system only leaves through the plants. So we see the transpiration loss, but we're not seeing the loss from runoff or leaching or evaporation into the atmosphere. And that reduces the water use by hydroponic and aquaponic systems down to, you know, less than 10% if you were growing in an equivalent crop, say of lettuce or tomatoes, in an open field.
I'm wondering about the potential here in terms of large-scale commercial aquaponics. I mean, what's the potential for that?
The potential we're seeing now is quite good. A lot of folks are interested in fresh, locally grown produce and fresh, locally grown fish as well. You were mentioning walleye. Sounds like you're already, you've got your fork and knife and plate for that fish fry. So there's a lot of potential. However, there are some pitfalls. It's difficult to get to a scale where you can compete with, you know, the outdoor production facilities. An aquaponic system is still a huge investment. Now, an aquaponic system can produce an equivalent amount of fish and an equivalent amount of crops for, you know, less than two separate systems would, but you have a whole lot of infrastructure when you're getting started and a lot of costs and inputs in addition to the money you're saving on fertilization and filtration for the water quality. So there are opportunities, but there's a big jump between, say, a small system in your home or school and a full-size commercial system where you can maybe compete with grocery stores since, you know, for most foods, margins are very low. So finding that is tricky and can take a lot of investment.
Yeah, that's why walleye would be good, because I think walleye is kind of a high-value product.
Yeah, that's part of the trick, is finding a high-value product or a niche market where you can compete. So maybe selling at farmers markets to customers who will pay you that premium for fresh local produce or fish fillets. So it's still going to be more expensive than either wild-caught salmon or outdoor cultivated aquaculture salmon or other fish. You're going to have more inputs in an aquaponic system, so you also need to find a market that will pay you that premium price.
Well, at the home gardener level, let's take it there. How much technical knowledge or know-how do you need to set up an aquaponic system?
You can do it with some very simple systems and materials. Like I said, I would, if I was starting, and when I did start, I reached out to people who already had systems, who knew what they were doing. So finding a network of folks to give you advice is really, in my mind, essential and helps, you know, prevent some of the easy errors. But it's certainly within the grasp of anyone who, you know, is interested as a gardener or as an aquarium enthusiast. So neither of these things is unattainable. But it is a new set of skills, and it's always beneficial to get advice and find good resources.
As I understand it, there are three main aquaponic systems. There's this medium-based, I think it's called, there's a nutrient film and raft system. And how do you choose the right system for you?
Oh, that's a good question. So yes, so there are three basic systems that we see in most aquaponic systems. And if I were choosing one, I would think about, you know, what sort of systems and environment do I already have? For a homeowner, I would probably recommend starting with a medium-based system. So by medium, we're talking about a media or a support system for the plants themselves. the fish tanks pretty much stay the same in all three of these systems, but what you're talking about is how are you growing the plants. The medium-based system is a little more forgiving, and that makes it a good option for homeowners. You can also have a smaller planting bed area for your plants and get good good nutrition. The raft system is what I'm currently using at the DC Smith Greenhouse. So we have, the plants are growing in basically, you know, foam board insulation rafts that float on the surface of the water. That's why we call it a raft system or a deep water system, because the water depth is deeper than it is in the other systems. I'm growing that way, but I want to convert maybe after this summer, after the current school is done and I'm setting up the new school year. I'm going to try a medium system next fall. So instead of having deep water with rafts floating on the top, I'm going to fill our water tanks, which are, they're about a foot deep, with a type of medium called expanded clay. So it's these clay pellets, and you can buy them under a number of different brand names. But that's a media. So the plant roots, instead of floating on the water, grow in that, and that media holds the nutrition. So I'm going to try a media system, and that's probably the one that I think is most attainable for homeowners. After that, a raft system is fairly simple. The NFT system, which is nutrient film technique, is probably, you know, a higher technical level. It has a very thin film of water. You're constantly having the water flow, and there's not much of a buffer. So if your pump breaks down, your plant roots get dry really fast. So the buffering in that system isn't as good, say, as in the raft, where they still have water even if your electricity goes out, or in the media system where, again, you still have water. The nutrient film technique is more reliant on a constant supply of power to move the water around.
So under that media system, basically, how big a tank would you need and how much media, you know, to actually grow the plants and enough for your home use?
Certainly. So for a home system, I'm glad you specified that, because it's really going to depend on what you're doing. For a home system, you know, you could get away with, say, a 40 or 60 gallon fish tank, and that would supply, say, a, you know, 2 foot by 4 foot or a 2 foot by 6 foot system with plants in it that would provide the nitrogen that that many plants would need. It's going to depend a little bit on what kind of plants you are growing. Leafy greens like basil that I'm growing or lettuces are going to grow faster and need fewer nutrients than, say, a fruiting vegetable like a tomato or a cucumber. In general, I recommend leafy green crops because the turnover is faster. So the crop only takes, say, you know, 4 to 6 weeks to grow, and then you're ready to harvest, rather than tomatoes where you plant them and then you don't get your first harvest for 2 months. You know, for all the people who are chomping at the bit to get their tomato plants in the ground, wait a little while longer. We might still get frost here in southern Wisconsin, and certainly in northern Wisconsin we'll see it. So wait. And yeah, again, you won't get your first tomatoes till the end of July.
But you can get some lettuce pretty quick. Under this system. Johanna Oosterwijk, our guest today, instructional manager of the D.C. Smith Greenhouse on the UW-Madison Department of Plant and Agro-Ecosystem Sciences. Great to have her with us as we talk aquaponics. And again, I'll invite you to join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Looking ahead to tomorrow on the show, writer and music enthusiast Tom Wilmoth is back to share his spring playlist, so we'll be playing lots of music in that first hour of the show. We'll get a preview of Cheech's Dees Fest later on from performer Greg Hall, and then we talk with members of the La Crosse-based band Toaster Ghost. That's tomorrow on the Larry Mueller Show. Right now, though, we're talking aquaponics with Johanna Oosterwijk. instructional manager at the D.C. Smith Greenhouse on the UW-Madison campus. Great to have her back as we talk with her about aquaponics. Questions and experience to share? I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address talk@WPR.org. Let's talk a little bit more about, what pest infestations, I guess we could call it. Are the plant and fish vulnerable to pest infestations?
Well, the short answer is yes, just like any other farming or gardening system. We've got some things that make it easier in a greenhouse system. So we put vents on the windows, screens on the vents, just like you put mosquito netting on your windows at home. So we're able to keep out a lot of the pests, but we do still have issues with things like aphids, thrips, spider mites, and whiteflies. Most of our efforts are put into preventing those from getting into the system, though. Because especially since we are now including a food animal in the system, we're even more limited on what kinds of controls we are able or willing to use in this system. So rather than using chemical pesticides, I am emphasizing the use of biological controls in this system, because we've got the plants that are a food, and we also have the fish, which are another organism and are often susceptible to those chemical pesticides that we might want to spray on things like aphids. They might also harm our fish. So in an aquaponic system, we do most of our work beforehand by trying to prevent pests from getting into the system. Having a controlled environment with screens on the vents helps with that. And then when we do run into a pest outbreak, we're going to emphasize biological controls like parasitic wasps to control aphids, or fungal pathogens that will kill thrips or spider mites. For spider mites, we also have predatory mites that can be used to control those. So we try to avoid the use of pesticides in aquaponic systems, because we're doing food crops, and those folks who are willing to give you a premium for your fresh local produce are probably also very interested in what inputs you use. So reducing being able to say we are, you know, chemical pesticide free, we are using a natural fertilizer instead of a synthetic fertilizer, helps to get people be willing to, you know, give us the return on that if, you know, we're growing as a commercial concern.
And on the fish side, I imagine there are some things that could attack fish as well.
There are also some diseases that we have to be concerned of and look for. The same things that would attack your fish in an aquarium or fish tank. So we can hopefully prevent those by, again, paying attention to water quality, making sure that you have the temperature and the pH level that is healthy for your fish, and also being careful about the source of the fish that we buy in. So when I buy new fish, I get them from a fish producer who does tests, checks, make sure that I'm not bringing in any diseases with the fish that I have. Harvesting fish from the wild would be really, it would be dangerous in the way that bringing a plant in from outside, you could be bringing in pests or diseases that you then have to deal with. There's also the issue with food safety. So a wet environment is a great place for, well, bacteria that we want, those bacteria mm-hmm. that convert ammonia into nitrate, we want to have those around. But there are a lot of other bacteria that can cause food safety issues. So keeping things clean, doing tests to make sure that you don't have those bad bacteria, using a safe water source. So if you have a well, making sure that it gets tested, you're going to test it before you want to drink that water yourself. And you want to test that water to make sure that there are no contaminants or pathogens for your fish and for your plants. If you have a surface water source, or if you're collecting rainwater, you want to test and care for that to make sure that your fish, your plants are healthy, and that anyone eating your crop or your produce are also going to stay safe and healthy.
Yeah, for sure. Well, a lot of people have been wondering about the upfront costs for a system and at the sort of the home gardener level, let's put it.
Yeah, so the home gardener level, you can certainly, you know, purchase a system or a kit to put together, and you can find those for a few thousand dollars. There are online DIY systems that you can put together for certainly under $1,000. A system like the one that we have in the DC Smith Greenhouse, it's a larger system, and it was purchased by a company that makes those kits for, you know, mid-size groups. They're for schools, and they sell them for several thousand dollars. You can get more bells and whistles and spend more money. But it's certainly a DIY project that you could do for less than $1,000 at home. There's a bunch of different pieces. You've got the fish tank, the pumps to move the water around. You want a plant tank. And then you also need a buffer in between there. You'll want another tank sort of for the bacteria and for what we call degassing to allow the excess products as the bacteria turn the ammonia into nitrate to gas off and get out of the system. So there are a couple of pieces that you need. It's not, you know, not free unless you're really good at upcycling stuff.
Dana in Green Bay wonders if you can transplant plants started in an aquaponic system. Could you transplant those plants to soil? Dana said they started peppers in a small countertop aquaponic system, but is looking to get them to grow bigger.
Again, short answer, yes, you could. It would depend. They'll need a little bit of extra care. So plants that are growing, say, in a deep water culture system where they're growing with their roots trailing in the water, those water roots have a different morphology to them than roots that plants grow in soil. So they're more delicate and fragile. So you will, I wouldn't put them directly outside in the heat of the sun, for example. I would plant them into, say, a pot where you can monitor the water and make sure that you're caring for them. They don't get too hot, too exposed to wind. So they'll kind of need a hardening period is what we call that. Just like the plants that you buy in the greenhouse might struggle when you take them outside, you do want to do kind of a buffer and let them toughen up before you put them out into the harsh world in full sun and windy situations. So the roots are going to need to toughen up just like the leaves and the stems of the plant would as well. If you are currently like growing it in some sort of a media or a potting mix, that's going to be an easier transition than if they are growing completely in water, like with a deep water culture system. A plant that had been grown in a media system would be easier to transplant and more agreeable to that stress.
And somebody has mentioned you can use mason jars for a countertop aquaponic system as well. So you could probably get down pretty inexpensively.
Potentially, yeah. So I would be concerned, you could certainly do hydroponics that way. I would be concerned about the fish and the fish getting enough oxygen.
Yeah.
So I mentioned water pumps in an aquaponic system. We also have air pumps because the fish need to breathe. The plants also need to breathe. Their roots need oxygen. And turning all of that ammonia into nitrate takes a lot of oxygen. You swap out the hydrogens for oxygen. You've got to give them air. So I would say possibly, but I would be worried about the fish being able to breathe in a mason jar.
Yeah,
and you'd have to have a pretty big mason jar, depending on what kind of fish you had.
On that note, Johanna, it's a pleasure talking with you. I appreciate it very much. We learned a lot about aquaponics, and we'll have you back and do this again. Thank you so much.
Thanks for inviting me, Larry. Great to see you.
Great to see you. Johanna Oosterwyk, instructional manager of the D.C. Smith Greenhouse on the UW-Madison Department of Plant and Agrosystem Sciences, our guest today. Yeah, fun having her and fun learning a bit about aquaponics and whether or not you can do it or want to do it. We're going to stay in the water a bit, but we're going to take a look at canoeing and kayaking on it instead of maybe growing plants on it. That coming up next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.
Can I canoe you up the river? Can I canoe you up the stream? Can I canoe you up the river like I did in last night's dream?
A little music to get us started here as we talk canoeing and kayaking. You know, in December and January and February, it's pretty tough to canoe and kayak here in Wisconsin, unless you want to do it on top of ice most of the time. But spring is here, and spring paddling is on our minds as we talk about canoeing and kayaking with a couple of experts. Darren Bush, one of them, owner and chief paddling evangelist for Rutabaga Paddle Sports in Madison. Darren, good to have you back.
Great to be here. Thank you.
With us as well, Timothy Bauer, author of the 2016 guidebook, Canoeing and Kayaking in Southern and South Central Wisconsin, 60 Paddling Adventures Within 60 Miles of Madison. It has a forthcoming guidebook covering the Driftless area.
That's right. Hi, Larry.
Coming up. Hi, Timothy. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Darren.
Hello, Timothy.
And hello, everyone outside.
trying to sound like Norman Gilliland. You
know, it's hard. He's got that voice.
He's got that gravelly voice.
He's got the voice.
And sometimes he's in the studio right next to us, right. But I don't see him in there now. Well, let's talk about paddling, and maybe you're ready to dip a paddle in your favorite lake or stream. And I hope you will give us a call. Maybe you've got a lake or stream you want to talk about. Maybe you've got a question about canoeing or kayaking equipment. Maybe an experience to share. You can call us at 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Darren, how eager should we be to get out paddling this time of the year on our lakes and streams?
Well, it's kind of hard not to be. I'm actually going on Saturday. I'm going to head up and paddle up in the Driftless. I'm going to paddle the Kickapoo, and then possibly Coon Valley has a little stream in it, so I might hit that one too. But it's our 41st wedding anniversary, and my wife wanted to go paddling this weekend. So,
what a great way to celebrate the anniversary. Yeah.
I'm married up.
And Timothy, for you?
I try to get out as often as I can. There certainly is a palpable spring fever that takes hold this time of year. But there are some prospects, even during the cold months that you laid out, where sometimes you might be breaking through ice. But at least down here in South Central Wisconsin, there are a few select streams that if you choose carefully and you're mindful about the time you're out there, you could find some open water.
Yeah. And Darren, I know you've often said that the most dangerous day to paddle is the first day we hit 75 degrees.
Right. And that's because a lot of people who get in trouble, especially in the smaller sort of recreational kayaks that they pick up at the, you know, Farm and Fleet or whatever, hey, it's a beautiful day, let's go for a paddle in the, you know, 70 degrees, sunny and beautiful, but the water's still like 45. Mm-hmm. And then you get out there and you get flipped over and you get in trouble and you get this thing called cold water immersion shock, where you feel like you can't breathe. And if you're mindful, you can paddle. If you dress for immersion, you can paddle. It's just it's what you don't know that you don't know that gets you in trouble.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You need to be dressed properly, and you need to be wearing a flotation device. Let's call it a life vest.
Life vest, personal flotation device, whatever you call it.
Were they ever jackets?
Life jackets?
Yeah. I mean, they're often still called that, but I've yet to see one with sleeves.
No, they were. There was that Sportsman company years ago that made, they called it the float coat, and it looked like a regular jacket, but it was a PFD, and mostly for duck hunters and such. Uh-huh. But yeah, I've never heard of anybody, very few people get in trouble when they have a life jacket on. There's just a death up by the Dells, mm-hmm. Where a fishing boat turned over and they didn't have life jackets on. They were right there ready for them to grab, but in that situation, you don't really have the, you know, the situational awareness to grab it and put it on because you're dealing with 40 degree water.
Yeah. And it was really high, too.
Yeah,
it was all that turbulence below the dam kicks up very aerated water that is, you really can't manage your way through it. It's different because of all the oxygen.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Let's be careful out there, right?
Tim, many paddling guidebooks older than yours say the ideal time to paddle is mid-April to early June. Is that advice still valid, do you think?
That's a good question. Those guidebooks certainly had the right intention, and it was relevant at the time, usually referring to whitewater rivers, or at least rivers with a steep enough gradient that you're going to frequent class 2, 3, 4 rapids. So big waves. And all that water volume plus the gradient doesn't stay around for a long time. So they would map out on the calendar kind of like between mid-March or April to about like Memorial Day or so, when the ice finally melted and the snow melt. And you still have that for some rivers up north. You know, sometimes northern Wisconsin and southern Wisconsin feel like two distinctly different states. Down here, you know, the last two winters, we have had very little snow. Last year, we had snow on the ground for about 2 weeks, and then it was gone. And this year, we had like 5 or 7 inches for a few days, and that's about it. So we don't have snow melt. We have these periodic, episodic, intense thunderstorms that can bring 2 to 4 inches of rain, you know, in a 24-hour period. And so you have these sudden flashes of our rivers down here. But if you give them enough time, sometimes as little as 2 or 3 days, they come right back down. It's just you don't want to be on it right then and there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm the Kickapoo. I'm watching water levels up there right now because you want it to be between like 200 and 300 cubic feet per second. That's kind of the level. Above that, it gets kind of muddy and pushy. I don't mind that in my boats with my gear, but most people shouldn't do that. And then down below 100, 125, you start just to scrape the bottom all the time. So each river has its own little window, and Tim's guidebooks actually have that window in them. So it's super useful.
And I know last week, I think it was the Black and the Yellow Rivers in Jackson and Wood counties were reported at flood stage.
Yeah.
Yep.
You don't want to be out there then.
Still that way now, I think. And again, they'll come down. The Black itself is one of my favorite rivers, so I keep my own little attention and vigil to it. And it's already half the volume it was 48 hours ago. So they do come down about as quickly as they do go up. But there's still that window of time you want to stay off of it.
One of my favorites is the Grant, which is down south of Lancaster and runs into the Mississippi at Potosi. I call it like the baby Kickapoo. Mm-hmm. It's got some similar bluffs, but I don't see anybody on it. But it drains 800 square miles, which sounds like a lot, but it's not, right? Mm-hmm. So they'll get a thunderstorm, and it'll pop up 6 feet, and then it'll go right back down again within 12, 13 hours. So if you paddle these little rivers and look up into the trees and the fences, you'll see corn, like corn stalks and stuff bent around these fences. And it's like, well, how did they get up there? I said, well, they did in about 2 hours, and then down again. So the smaller the drainage area, the more likely you are to see large fluctuations when they get hit.
And for knowing that, what's the best way? You were right on top of things, Timothy, I think, too. Well, probably Darren as well. But
so there are two online gauges, I think, that we typically look at. One is through NOAA, N-O-A-A, and the other is through the USGS. Geological services. Each shows you a map. So there's a Wisconsin version for both of those websites. You could also look up neighboring states, etc. And for the USGS site, the state is kind of punctuated with colored dots, and each dot represents a gauge on a certain river. Unfortunately, we don't have gauges for every single stream in Wisconsin. Sure. That'd be a lot of dots. And the other really nuancy thing that's important to keep in mind is that the dots are colored. And they range from black, meaning very high, to red, meaning very low. Green is usually like the median color. Green
it's
does not
25 to 75% yeah. of normal, something like that.
Right. Yeah. So what green? The dots don't necessarily mean like too high or too low or just right. It's not a Goldilocks thing. What the dots, the colors indicate what the historical average is for that time of year. So the day you're looking at it, if we looked it up today, April 23rd, you'd see a lot of blue and black dots because it's spring and that's normal for the rivers to be high. It doesn't mean, again, that it's not that they're too high. It just means that they're higher for what their average is for this time of year. That's all very wonky stuff. On the milespaddle.com website, we have a whole special feature that we spent a fair amount of time coming up with called How to Gauge Wisconsin Water Levels. Whatever search engine is your choice, if you just put all that in or just go to milespaddle.com in our search engine, How to Gauge Wisconsin Water Levels, there's a whole step-by-step feature about how to find the two sites, how to interpret the data. But if you're ever in doubt, ask someone. Ask a local, make a phone call to a paddling shop, to a fishing place, sometimes even a bar or restaurant that's on the river. They're going to know firsthand knowledge, you know, if it's high, if it's low, if it's dangerous, what the score is. You know, and as Darren, I've heard say, when in doubt, don't. I mean, let that be the bottom line. If you're feeling twitchy and uncomfortable in whatever category, it's not worth it.
Yeah. We've already gotten some requests for, and you mentioned where you're going for your wedding anniversary, but we want to know where are you two paddling this spring, or where do you recommend?
Well, any place that is wet, right? So I'll be on the Kickapoo, I'll be on the Grant, I'll be on, I mean, the Pecatonica, the east branch of the Pecatonica, everybody's like, oh, man, how can that be? It's like, you know what? It's a muddy little farm ditch, but it's my muddy little farm ditch, and I love it, right? Mm-hmm. I was on the Sugar 2 weeks ago with a photographer doing some drone shooting, which was really fun. So I'm going to the Boundary Waters, I'm going to do some longer trips, I'm going to Vilas County. But I always say, you know, saving your vacation for 1 week so you can go on a big trip is kind of like eating once a year, right? Mm-hmm. So I kind of graze and paddle stuff within half an hour of Madison. So I'll do the Wisconsin I haven't been on the Turtle before, and mm-hmm. I haven't been on the Bark before, and those are two on my list, and they're in Tim's book. Mm-hmm. So those are on the list.
Tim?
My favorite place to go is where I haven't been yet. But there are places like the Driftless in particular in springtime and again in autumn, but there's something I think synonymous almost with, the Driftless area in springtime. The real trick with that is, without leaves coming out yet, you can really see the rock outcroppings along the bluffs that the Driftless, you know, is abound with. It will seem kind of fickle, but there are certain streams I've been on the end of April, or let's say mid-April, and then returned to 3 weeks later, and it's a night and day difference. As soon as that wall of leafy green comes out, it's like, you know, the bluffs are there, but it's as though they've just all been camouflaged or, you know, been hidden behind the curtains. So there is a sweet little ephemeral window in springtime that I really holds dear for me for the Driftless area. But again, there's that call of whitewater, you know, in the northern half of the state when things really open up before they get drought ridden and too shallow and scrapey, which could start as early as June.
This weekend is Pesh Fest on the Peshtigo River up north, which is probably the largest whitewater gathering in Wisconsin. And it's the perfect time to do it. But I like to use the word ephemeral because one of the things I love about the Kickapoo this time of year is you can see all the spring ephemerals that are blooming along the shore because the trees haven't filled up yet in the understory. and Tim's going to help me. What's the name of that creek that runs in the Kickapoo just above Bridge 10?
Give me a second. Yeah, this is, always works well for radio.
yeah, take your time. I forgot. The water should be up enough for me to paddle that.
Yeah, it's spring fed, so I think you should pretty.
It's just south of Wildcat.
Yeah, no, I know exactly where it is. It's right by the ice cave. I'm just blanking on it now because we're on the radio.
Me too.
well, ponder it while I remind everybody we're talking canoeing and kayaking today with Darren Bush of Rutabaga Paddle Sports in Madison, and Timothy Bauer. Tim has a book out on canoeing, 60 paddling adventures within 60 miles of Madison, and a forthcoming guidebook covering the Driftless area. And you can join in at 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Is it Billings Creek?
I just looked it up.
well done. Yes.
Thank you.
I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. We are talking kayaking and canoeing in Wisconsin with our guest, Darren Bush, owner of Rutabaga Paddle Sports in Madison. Timothy Bauer is member of the Milespaddle.com. It's a website for all things paddling in the upper Midwest. It's great to have both of them with us. And again, you can join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. Now, I had another question about summer rivers. You know, which Wisconsin rivers streams do you consider safe to paddle in the summer, maybe as opposed to spring?
A lot of the big rivers are just too burly, have too much water volume, too muddy and tree debris in the springtime. So those would be rivers like the Wisconsin, to some degree, the lower Wisconsin, the lower Black, the lower Chippewa, the lower Wolf. By summertime, they've kind of plateaued, again, with the exception of, you know, high sudden rainfall, that they should be pretty good. And a lot of those, like the lower Black, Chippewa, Wisconsin, they're spectacular sandbar camping prospects. You have your choice of hundreds of islands. You feel like you're doing a backcountry trip, except that everything you could fit in a canoe, up to your cooler and camp chairs and grill if you're so inclined. So it's like having the best of car camping with a primitive feel to it. So those are some of my favorite places to go in the summertime.
Yeah. What about you, Darren?
Pretty much the same. I do love the lower Wisconsin, especially during the weeks, not on the weekends, because oftentimes I'll work on the weekend and then take Tuesday. And I've paddled Wisconsin in the summertime from Spring Green down to, you know, Lone Rock or Muscadet, and not seen a single other person on Tuesday or Wednesday. You go on the Saturday and it's going to be, you know,
busy.
But I mean, I love people. I don't like persons so much. So when I go paddling, I'm trying to usually be alone or with a small group. And the best way to do that is to paddle off work time.
Rex in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Rex.
Okay. First of all, I just wanted to say hello to Darren. And I think he knows me, Rex.
How long ago did you work for me? 15 years, something like that?
I think it's almost 30, maybe.
Holy cow.
But, yeah. And I also wanted to thank Tim for his book, and especially on the subject of bicycle shuttles. Oh. And I do a lot of that, and I think that it's an excellent way to go, get two forms of exercise. You can plant your bicycle one place and your car another place and hop in your boat. As far as a stream that seems to be good for it, that I do maybe once a week almost, is some part of the Sugar River. Uh-huh. Almost the whole way from Verona to Broadhead. You can do that sort of thing, and sometimes be on the state bike trail.
Right.
And Broadhead down to the Illinois border actually is gorgeous. It goes through, it's not Avon Bottoms, is it Avon Bottoms? Yeah, Avon Bottoms.
See, that I know. I don't know Billingsburg, but I know.
But it's a wildlife sanctuary. I don't know if it's a refuge or not, but it's certainly full. Right now, it's great. It's full of birds, and you can see them because there's no leaves.
Yeah.
Right.
Rex, thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. So bicycle shuttles, it's a great way to do it.
Well, Tim's book has the best and fastest and ways to do a bike shuttle with the traffic counts being low. In fact, I'm sure that bike shuttle is not something people are familiar with. So, Tim, explain what a bike shuttle is.
We had to tee that up. So I often paddle alone because I try to go to different places, especially if I'm doing some sort of, you know, research or recon on for a guidebook. I don't necessarily want to subject a beloved friend or my partner to something that I myself don't know. So I often paddle by myself. When you're paddling a river, you know, you go in only one direction. And unless you've lost a bet, you're not going to paddle back upstream to where you started. So you have to get back to your starting point. You could arrange a shuttle, maybe, depending on the area of the state you're in and if there is a livery service, but often there isn't, or I'm too frugal to do that. So I drop off a bike, and depending on the direction you're coming from, maybe you do the shuttle first, maybe you do it afterward. But the gist of it essentially is not only are you exercising your legs after sitting in a boat and using, you know, your core and your arms for the last few hours, it's nice to stretch out your legs. You also see the landscape from a completely different vantage point because when you're sitting in a boat and you're on, let's say, a river, the banks are all higher than you, typically, especially if you're in a hillier area. But when you're on the roads, whether that's, you know, driving road, county road, or even a bike trail, you could be as much as, you know, 20 feet higher up than the water you were just on only an hour ago. And I always find it kind of a neat before and after of seeing the landscape from two different perspectives.
That's a really cool
point. The only downside of it, if you're in the Driftless, is I did a bike shuttle on the Grant one time, and I didn't realize that it was straight up and straight down and straight up and straight down. And, but yeah, what I usually do is I'll drop my gear off at the top of the where I put it in, stick it under a bridge or whatever. I've never had anybody take anything usually, right? Drive to the end, drop my truck, ride my bike back to the canoe, lock it up, paddle down to my car, and pick my bike up on the way home. Works quite well.
I feel obliged to have a quick PSA that I have had stuff stolen. The strangest things, from bike lights to a water bottle to an actual cooler with my beverage still in it, which still bothers me to this day. So lock your stuff up. This is not to say, like, don't do this at all. Just don't assume always the best, because there are people who are going to take advantage. That said, of the several hundred bike shuttles I've done, I've only had something tampered with like three times. So those odds are pretty good.
So what style of canoe and kayak, is another question, are best for spring paddling, and for, is there a difference between spring and summer?
Well, the best kind of craft is the kind that fits the water you're on. So if you're going to paddle a small twisty turny river, like, I mean, Badfish Creek is just south of here, and it's twisty and turny. You want a shorter, more maneuverable boat, whether it's a canoe or a kayak. If you're going to paddle bigger open lakes, or like Wisconsin River, I consider a lake that moves, right? It's just it's a half a mile wide in lots of places, and it just moves. A flat water boat, I've paddled sea kayaks on the lower Wisconsin before. So basically, just you tune the boat to where you're paddling, not so much to spring versus summer.
Yeah. No, I totally agree.
Lucas in Jefferson has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Lucas.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I'm from the Jefferson area, which is my house is a stone's throw away from the Rock River. So I haven't been able to really venture out to there. It's just really me and my dog in my household. So I was wondering if your guests had any ideas or thoughts on including your pets with kayaking. And if there's any like specialized equipment that they know of that can help with that besides training your dog and having it wear like a life vest. Right.
Yeah. Treats. That's special gear.
I got this one. First of all, before I answer the question, I need to ask you a question. Tell me about the goats.
Mm-hmm.
What's with the goat island on the Rock?
Oh, the goat island. Yeah, we have a goat fest too here. Celebrate the goats. Pretty much just a way to mow the lawn every time, I guess. That's pretty much what I know of.
Yeah, so you're paddling down the Rock River and you come around the corner and there's an island full of goats.
Pile of goats.
That's the only place that's ever happened to me. Mm-hmm. Anyway, answering your question. So I have a 100-pound pure Newfie cross. Lucy is, she's big. Because I'm in the fortunate position of knowing people in the industry, I actually asked the folks at North Star Canoe, I said, can I come up and build a boat that's just for me and my dog? And they said, sure. So I took a small tandem and set it up as a solo, where I'm about 2 feet behind the center of the boat, behind the yoke, and then Lucy has the whole front. And so it balances because I'm about 200 pounds. She's about 100 pounds. So she's 4 feet from the center. I'm 2 feet from the center, and you can do the physics. So big is better. It depends on the animal, of course. My lab was, oh, boy, a couple treats, lay down. We're good for a couple hours. Lucy likes to eat milfoil. She likes to jump out and chase geese. But I just love paddling with my pooch. So yeah, a bigger, stabler, a little bit more space. If you try and cram them into a small cockpit, it's not going to go well for anybody.
Yeah, it makes good sense. Timothy, anything to add?
I had a Boston Terrier, pretty much the opposite of Darren's Lucy. and he put up with water to a point. He also put up with reality to a point. But one trick I found is if I could find some kind of public dry land for him to get out of the canoe, walk around, sniff, he was a little less anxious. And so I tried to choose places where I thought, okay, we could reasonably dry dock here for 10 minutes. He could run around for 5 minutes or so, and we'll get back in. And just, I kept the trips really short. I also did mostly lake paddling to avoid the shuttling logistics. I mean, that'll be different if you have two vehicles and it's not just you and your pooch. But if it is just the two of you, you might want to make sure you're paddling somewhere where you don't have a point A to point B type of trip.
I think our dogs are both black and white, and I think that's where it ends.
Yeah, pretty much.
And we had a question. You were talking about one or two people. Actually, it didn't have anything to do with one or two people. It was the advantages and disadvantages and trade-offs between a solo canoe and a kayak.
I love that question.
Well,
Darren,
go ahead and
I could
start.
Probably have an entire show about the solo canoe. I want to tee this off for you. I personally love a solo canoe because it's more comfortable for me. I can sit, I can kneel, I could stretch. I don't feel like I'm just more or less trapped in a which I sometimes do in a kayak. If I have to get in and out of the boat a lot because I'm on a river that no one paddles, and there's a lot of deadfall, it's really easy to get in and out of a canoe. Granted, it's a lot of boat sometimes, and sometimes you don't want to have that much surface area getting stuck on, you know, when there's down trees or whatnot. But I personally find that physically or physiologically, it fits me better, and it kind of just fits my temperament, my personality better.
Yeah. Darren?
Yeah, what he said. I own a dozen canoes, and six of them are solos. So, and that's not counting kayaks, but I don't know how many boats I have. I just have a bunch of boats. It's always a little bit fluid, but I love paddling solo canoes. And an example of what Tim was talking about is like on the Sugar River. You've got banks that are sometimes 3-4 feet higher than the water level. And if you come around the corner and there's a log down, you can maneuver around much easier in a canoe and kind of jump up and grab a handful of grass and haul yourself out. Whereas if you're in a kayak, you've got to figure out how to find a spot that's set up for you to get out of it. It doesn't mean there's not a place for kayaks. It just means for a lot of the water around here, a solo canoe is just a great tool. The other thing is you can use a kayak paddle to paddle a solo canoe. There's no rules against doing that. And so a lot of the canoes that we are selling more and more of are called pack canoes, which is basically a canoe you sit on the bottom of and paddle with a kayak paddle, kind of like a kayak without the top on, right? But it's easier to get in and out. A lot of folks with mobility issues, knees, you know, ankles, hips, whatever, find it much easier to get in and out of a pack boat than in and out of a kayak.
Makes sense. I want to go to the Driftless area a bit again. It's come up now quite, you know.
Let's always go to the Driftless once. Area.
I think you've talked about what you kind of love about the area, but
there is a history that you can sense with your eyes, your ears, your nose. It has, you know, a very distinctly different look than anywhere else in the state. I used to live in southern New England, so when I first saw the Driftless, I thought, yeah, this is very much like western Massachusetts, the rolling hills. I like topography. I like that it's really, really old. You know, we don't need to dive into the weeds here, but the Driftless area in southwestern Wisconsin is at least 2.5 million years old. It missed all the raising and landscaping, let's call it, of glaciation. And because of that, those river systems are ancient. They're intact. You get a sense of that really up close and personal. The rock formations that line the Driftless area are from, you know, an ancient ocean estimated to be almost 500 million years old. And so when Darren is talking about paddling down the Kickapoo River, you can literally touch, you know, rock that's 500 million years old. And it's sedimentary, it's fissured like a cake. It's just really pretty, especially this time of year. Everything is just coming into bud and burgeoning. The rivers are clean and singing. It's before, I mean, the Driftless area is also surrounded by a lot of farms. And a lot of farms mean runoff from the soil. Occasionally manure spills, it happens. That will tincture the water. But in springtime, it's still really pristine and clean.
And you missed the zero. They're actually, the river system is between 300 and 350 million years old.
Yeah.
It is arguably the oldest river system in the U.S., in North America. There's some dispute about the upper Missouri, but other than that, but it is, it's old. And one of the things I like about the bluffs is the plants that grow on it, because it's a lot of spring water that infuses itself through that sandstone. And if you just paddle up to it and stick your nose against it and breathe, it's a sensory experience.
Sure.
I always do that one. So, but are you kissing that wall? I said, no, I'm just breathing in 300 million year old stone and plant.
As one does.
As one does.
What's going to be in your new book?
Oh,
on
boy.
The Driftless?
Gosh. Well, I hope we can talk about that, you know, next year or so when it comes out. But I wanted to treat the entire Driftless area in one contained singular book. And so there's a little bit of controversy about whether we should even use the word Driftless for neighboring states, Iowa and Minnesota. But to me, you still call that Driftless because it wasn't affected by the glaciers of the last ice age. Were they glaciated a couple of million years ago? Yes. Does it look like the corresponding sides in southwestern Wisconsin and northwestern Illinois? Yes. So to me, it's all Driftless. There are about 30-ish rivers I spent a lot of time thinking about what to include and what not to include. But there's everything from tricky trout streams that will have water, enough water to paddle for only about 24 hours, to, and that are only about 20 feet wide, to, you know, rivers that are about 500 feet wide and will almost always have enough water. Really slow rivers, fast rivers with class 1-2 rapids, everything in between.
Tom in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Tom.
Good afternoon to all of you. Thanks for this excellent program. My wife and I do our fair share of paddling. We do the Nina Creek. We do Fox. We do crawfish stuff kind of around that Columbus, Marquette, Columbia County area for the most part. But we do stray. But we have noticed that as our experience has grown with every mile, our capabilities have changed because of our age. And we shifted from a really fast Winona that we had to a little bit wider boat and a little bit more stable. And that kind of had to do with us, you know. And I'm just wondering if there's anything as we age and you know, prosthetic knees and hips and stuff come in to play for many of us. Is there one that's better than the other, or, you know, it's all personal comfort and such, but yeah, we love it. And again, we realize that our balance isn't what it used to be. So yeah. We switched.
Last one off the water wins. So yeah, I used to race canoes, and then my race partner went away to medical school, and I'm like, I don't want to break another one in, because it's a fairly intimate thing. You get a rhythm with your race partner. And then I'm like, I don't like going fast anymore. I mean, I'm 63. I'm very happy to just go a little bit slower. And with rivers, it doesn't matter anyway, right? You've got now a mile or 2 mile an hour current to push you along. But yeah, I have boats that are a little bit less stable than some. I don't call them unstable. I call them a little tender. You have to be a little more careful with them. But I don't paddle them on the sugar in the winter. I'll take my more stable boats and paddle those. So the best boat is the one that gets wet the most. So you've done a good thing by switching to something that gives you a little bit more stability and comfort.
Yeah, and Tom, and I think you're just being sensible and honest with, you know, where you and, you know, your partner are at. You still go to the rivers. You know how they're going to be. You would be kind of dishonest to yourself if you forced it or whatnot. But you're going with what's comfortable for you, what's the best paddling for you, but you're returning to the rivers that you love. And I think that's the exact right way to go about it.
Yeah, makes good sense. And Stephanie in Madison has a question for us. Let's go there. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi. I'm wondering about inflatable kayaks in Wisconsin. I've used one in Colorado, and I really appreciate how gentle they are when you run into something. But I wonder if they transfer to our Wisconsin environment well.
They do. And when he first said Stephanie from Madison, I'm like, why is my wife calling me?
That's what I was thinking. Is this being set up?
Yeah. When are you coming home from work? yeah, they work great. And inflatables aren't what people think they are. They used to think of them as sort of big beach toys that kind of look like what people think a canoe looks like, but it isn't. They've gone to a different technology. The bottoms of them often use what's called the drop stitch, which basically gives you the ability to make a big, flat, 15 PSI board. It's like a right. basketball, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they paddle more like hard shell boats. But the other thing is pack boats. They're becoming a thing as well. And we've got a pack boat that we sell that's 20 pounds. So you can take that and put it on the back of your bike and paddle to the river, or pedal to the river, inflate it, paddle down, and paddle back up again, or pedal back up again. So if you've got an e-bike and a small inflatable, the world is your oyster, right? And they're also they're usually a bit less expensive than a hard shell boat, and you know, there's some compromises with performance, but on a river, who cares? And to that point about performance, a friend of mine went out for a paddle, for a 2-hour paddle in his fast boat. Then he went for a 2-hour paddle in his slower boat. And the difference in the time it took him to do the same course was 5 minutes.
Wow.
So if you go to the Boundary Waters and, oh, I'm going to get a fast boat, I'm going to go. It's like, yeah, let them, right? You'll get there 10 minutes later and they'll have dinner going. So, yeah, just take it easy. Last one off the water wins, right?
It's like driving in that regard too. You could drive 10 miles per hour over the speed limit, just cruise through red lights. You're only going to get home like 3 minutes faster. Yeah, meanwhile, yeah. You've done all this public safety issues. Yeah. The thing I'd say about inflatables, in addition to everything Darren just laid out, you don't have to worry about a roof rack. You don't have to worry about a trailer. It folds up really small in a compartmentalized size that fits in the back of your car. There's no wind resistance. It's really easy. You don't have to worry about your shoulders, getting a boat on and off the car, straps, etc., wind. That's a real advantage to be able to just do that, get in and out. That's true whether you're going only 30 minutes from your house or 3,000 miles.
I think our number one demographic of purchasing those are people in campers or RVs. Because they want to paddle too, but try and get a canoe on top of a big old Airstream. Good luck.
Darren Bush and Tim Bauer, our guests today, as we talk paddling with them. And I'm Larry Mueller, and you are listening to WPR News. Talking with Darren Bush of Rutabaga Paddle Sports in Madison, Timothy Bauer, Tim, member of MilesPaddle.com, a website, and he's authored a wonderful book on canoeing and kayaking in South Central Wisconsin as well. He's got another book that'll be coming out on the Driftless area. Great to have him with us. George in Madison has a question or comment, I believe. George, hi.
Hi. Thank you, gentlemen, for talking today. I'm a senior citizen who does a lot of canoeing and short canoes on twisty rivers like the Badfish Creek and the Mekan River. Mm-hmm. And I've been disappointed to see the extent to which some other enthusiasts have cleared out some of the obstacles in these streams.
Yeah.
Is there some kind of ethic or guidance on the extent to which people should do that?
I don't know if there is a hard and fast rule, George. I think a lot of it's subjective, and a lot of it's going to be prone to safety. I think I'm going to get a little bit out of my lane here and say, like, I know for some fishing folks and ecologists, having deadfall in the water is good for habitat. I don't disagree one iota. But if I'm coming upon a twist on either the Badfish or Mekan, and full disclosure, I have sawed lots of limbs on both streams, I do so only with a minimalist approach to allow the narrowest passage that will be safe for paddlers, because I know someone's going to be behind me, either literally, part of me that day, or the next day, the next week, the next month. And I care more, frankly, about a recreational paddler and their safety by snapping off or cutting off one or two limbs. I keep everything else intact, but that I'm guilty of that, and I frankly will stand by that, because I've seen too many people get stuck in trees and go through total panic attacks, rightfully so, and have not been back inside a boat because of that.
I'm on the same page. I usually carry a bow saw with me, and mostly in the spring. Usually outfitters will keep things pretty clean, but like the Upper Sugar, I don't think I saw a single downed tree that wasn't at least modified a little bit. Yeah. So they'll cut out, I'll cut out like a 3 or 4 foot swath, right, where people can kind of get their boats through there. But I fully agree that leaving the rest of it in the river for fish habitat or just frankly for aesthetics, I don't like things to be clean.
Right.
Right.
And part of it is the fun, the challenge of navigating, negotiating space, how to get around something. Do you go under it, over it, left, right, etc.? I want to keep that as intact for people as possible. And I think there is a reasonable compromise between that negotiation and public safety.
Before we close out for sure, I wanted to mention the 60th anniversary of the Wild Rivers Act. and a guy by the name of Dave Martin. Tim, you want to?
Yeah, be happy. Thank you for the opportunity. A lot of this, frankly, I myself have learned only in the last couple of months, thanks to the River Alliance of Wisconsin, reminding all of us that year 2025 marks the 60th anniversary of, frankly, benchmark legislation done in 1965. It started with the Pine, Popple, and Pike Rivers in the very northeastern nook of the state. And essentially what it means is development is prevented along those rivers, or at least certain corridors of the rivers, not the entire river lengths themselves. And what this does, in effect, is preserve the rivers then so that in 1965 they could look like what they looked like earlier in the 20th century. And today, 60 years later, they still look like what they looked like in 1965. That legislation in the state, which I think is also worth noting, was passed unanimously. It was bipartisan, and that is unheard of in today's contentious world of politics. But this, everyone, Republican, Democrat, was on board with this in 1965.
And Dave Martin was a Republican.
He was a Republican and was signed into law by Republican Gaylord Nelson at the time.
Do you know Fred Madison? Remember him?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Dr. Dirt, who he passed away a couple of years ago. He was sitting in the office with Lyndon Johnson when they put this together. See, he was one of the original guys that did this, and he's from Madison. So
yeah, and right. So to Darren's point, 3 years later on the federal level, Congress passed the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act in 1968, which also protected the St. Croix, Namekagon, and the Wolf Rivers here in Wisconsin. But it started off as a homegrown thing.
So did Earth Day.
Yeah, right? So did Earth Day, also signed into law by the same Gaylord Nelson.
And I think it was March 7th, Dave Martin passed away at the age
He was, I think, like 93.
93 years old.
Yeah. I know.
He had an amazing, amazing life and kind of an amazing guy.
He's certainly an inspiration because it's a good example too that, today we're often surrounded by, we're tagged. You're an environmentalist, but you could be a conservationist and be within conservationist is to conserve. You could be a conservative who still cares about wildlife, wild places, and in this case, wild rivers.
A couple of other questions. Somebody was wondering about the maneuverability of the inflatable.
They're usually quite maneuverable. They're sort of designed that way. The pack boats I'm talking about are very popular out west. So you'll see guys in Colorado that will hike up to a little stream and then they'll fish it and then they'll hike back down again with their 17-pound boat. But yeah, there it's all related to length and the shape of the bottom and all that. But some of them do have a little skeg, a little fin you can insert it to make them track a little bit straighter if you're going on open water, and then pull it off when you get to the river.
And somebody else, and we're just about out of time, but wondering if you're interested in paddling streams, is there anything different from paddling down a river in a stream?
No.
Scale.
Yeah. I mean, with the gradient, how fast it's flowing, and also the countryside. Are you in farmland? Are you in a forest? Very different experiences.
So it's six of one, half a dozen of the other.
Yeah. I mean, the more remote place you are, you're going to be limited to how many accesses there are in dry land, like how many bridges there are. So that might affect, exactly where you're going. But to my recognition, there is no difference between a river and a creek. there are plenty, like Turtle Creek is called a creek, and it's
not a creek.
Almost 300 feet wide in places. So
where I come from, it's called a crick.
A crick, right. Yeah.
Darren Bush and Tim Bauer, our guests today. Darren, owner of Rutabaga Paddle Sports. Timothy Bauer, member of MilesPaddle.com. Take a look at that website as well for all things paddling in the upper Midwest. Great to have them with us. And always great to have the team that we've got, Joel Patnaud and Clara Neipert, our producers. Technical directors are Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins, and our executive producer, Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you for listening and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News. And Rutabaga Paddle Sports, by the way, is one of our many business sponsors. Great to have them as well.